This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary, sitting in for Neil Conan in Washington. The abortion debate has sat on the front burner of American politics since the Roe versus Wade decision more than 30 years ago. But Sandra Day O'Connor's recent resignation from the Supreme Court promises to bring the issue back to a boil. Both pro-life and pro-choice forces see the Supreme Court vacancy as an opportunity that must be seized. Money is pouring into activist coffers, protesters have hit the streets, ads from both sides are already on the airwaves. But after three decades of arguing over abortion, the terms of the debate have hardly changed. Both sides seem to overlook the fact that a majority of Americans say they want the Supreme Court to uphold Roe v. Wade, but also support some restrictions on abortion. In other words, there are a lot of gray areas in a debate that is usually framed in terms of black and white. Later in the program, the Olympic impact on East London and fashion under the golden arches. But first, common ground in the abortion debate. We'll take a look at the current legal landscape surrounding abortion, and we'll ask the heads of Republicans for Choice and Democrats for Life about how to find the common ground. Whatever your views on abortion, do you believe the two sides can work together on shared goals? Is there a common ground? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is TOTN@NPR.org. With us now in Studio 3A to get the conversation going is NPR's health policy correspondent, Julie Rovner. Julie, great to have you here.
Nice to be here.
Well, Sandra Day O'Connor, of course, was considered a conservative, and yet many of her votes were seen as supportive of abortion rights. So what impact might her replacement have on this abortion issue?
Well, you're going to hear both sides in the coming debate argue that she's going to that this will be a pivotal change, that the pro-choice side are going to say that, you know, we could see a real turn back. Pro-life side is going to say, but Roe versus Wade isn't in danger. And in some ways, they're both right. What we've seen with Justice O'Connor is that in 1992, she wrote what was considered the controlling decision in a key case that actually reframed Roe, said that there is a right to abortion. We're not going to overturn that, but it's not going to be quite as broad as it had been before. So she basically signaled that, like most of the country, she is for a right to abortion, but with restrictions. Now, having said that, in ensuing cases, she's actually been more on the pro-choice side than the pro-life side, which was not the case before that. She had actually, when she came to the court, she actually was voted with the bloc that tended to be for more restrictions and a little bit against Roe versus Wade. So what we can see is that some of these cases where there was a 5-4 decision, the most, I think, important one being the 2000 case where this court struck down a Nebraska law outlawing the procedure that's known as partial birth abortion. There's a federal law on that that's now working its way through the courts. That was a 5-4 decision. She was on the 5 side that struck the law down. Mm-hmm. There would be a possibility that her successor could reverse that, be a 5-4 ruling to uphold that.
Okay. Now, Sandra Day O'Connor, as I understand it, created the idea of that there can be no undue burden. Let's talk about what that means, that idea of undue burden in terms of getting an abortion.
Well, this goes back originally to Roe versus Wade, which established abortion as a fundamental right that could only be regulated with a test that passed strict scrutiny. And what Sandra Day O'Connor had advocated for several years and finally sort of wrote into legal jurisprudence in 1992 was the idea that maybe the right shouldn't be that broad, that it shouldn't be considered a fundamental right. Rather, the state does have an interest in regulating abortion. They simply cannot have a regulation that would be considered an undue burden on that right. So she established the idea of maybe it's a little bit easier to have some regulations. In fact, in that case in 1992, the court upheld certain regulations that it had struck down previously, a 24-hour waiting period and what they call informed consent, where women have to listen to a speech about how abortion actually works. Those are things that had been considered not constitutional under the original Roe framework, but okay under this sort of new undue burden test.
But there's no real specific definition for what that undue burden means, right?
No.
I mean, it has to be tested every single time?
It has to be tested every single time, and that's been sort of one of the complaints about it, is that it's hard to, you don't really know what an undue burden is until it gets to the Supreme Court.
Yeah. So we have coming up now, what are some of the cases that we have coming up immediately that that are going to affect, that we need to look at in terms of abortion?
In the next term, the court has taken a case from New Hampshire on a New Hampshire parental notification law, although interestingly, the issue is not so much parental notification, which the court has upheld many times in many cases. Basically, they've said that it is legal to require that a parent be notified before a teenager can have an abortion. However, there must be a judicial bypass if there are situations in which the teen does not want to approach a parent, usually in the case of incest, some sort of abuse, but also other cases if the teen is mature enough to go to a judge. What's at issue in this New Hampshire case, however, is that there is an exception that can be made to that notification if the life of the teenager is in danger, but not if her health is in danger. Mm-hmm. This is the issue on which the last partial birth abortion case turned, and the issue on which the federal one may turn also, because the court has said repeatedly that there must be an exception for a woman's health as in addition to her life. Pro-life forces have said that renders legislation meaningless because health has been interpreted to mean mental health, and obviously any woman who is pregnant against her desires is going to be stressed and have some mental duress, so that could make it would make the exception the rule.
What do all these incremental decisions mean, really, ultimately, in terms of Roe v. Wade? The way you're describing it, as you're sitting here talking about it, I'm starting to think, you know, this seems like just endless court cases.
It feels, on the one hand, it feels like endless court cases. On the other hand, there is something to say about a right to abortion that is not available. There's an issue of access. I think that's what the pro-choicers have been saying over the years. Now, there are fewer and fewer people actually providing abortion services. Abortion has been marginalized, if you will, sort of out of hospitals into freestanding surgical centers, and it's easier to then target those if you're protesters. So there are many more counties in which abortion is not available, and I think that's the concern about some of these regulations, is that while the public may support the idea of many of these regulations, in fact, you may get to a point where there's so many regulations that it's a right without any ability to exercise.
Yeah, we're talking about middle ground here on the show, and if there is any middle ground on abortion, what is that middle ground? How do we reach that middle ground so that this debate is not as divisive as it has been over the many years? If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. And let's talk about that middle ground a little bit, Julie. I'm just wondering, you know, how do the two sides, pro-life, pro-choice, I'm not talking about the big middle ground right now, but the two sides, how do they view these battles around these restrictions? Does a pro-life, for instance, see it as a way to get at abortion, or I mean, how do they view it?
Well, basically, what happens is that each side advocates the issues that are sort of that they have the biggest majority on. So what you end up seeing is the debate become polarized rather than brought to the middle. In the case of the pro-lifers, they know that the public supports abortion more strongly very early in pregnancy, and as you go further in the pregnancy, they support it less. So if they take something that they dub partial birth abortion, which happens in the late second, early third trimester, there's something where the public can mobilize in favor of that. On the other hand, the other side will talk about the morning after pill, birth control, or even RU486, which actually is an abortion pill, which the morning after pill, that's another debate. But they'll go to the beginning of pregnancy, right, where abortion is much more accepted, and they'll look at that. They'll talk about sex education. They'll talk about preventing pregnancy. So it's a matter of each side retreating to its corners of the boxing ring, if you will, and yet sort of never get to that middle ground.
All right, let's see if we can take a call now. There's Woody in Miami, Florida. Hi, Woody.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good. Go ahead.
Okay, I don't think there should be. It's going to be a compromise. I'm not for compromise. It's either... I am for abortion, and I think it's a woman's choice.
It's a woman's choice, but do you believe in the possibility that there can be some restrictions on abortion, that there's some cases in which abortion should be restricted?
I don't think so. And first of all, it's a woman's choice call on that also, and I think it's a religious matter, church separation of church and state thing. And I don't think there should be a compromise, and this will go on endlessly forever.
You think it's going to go on endlessly forever?
Endlessly forever and ever.
There's nowhere where you can see compromise at all?
No.
Okay. All right. Well, there you go. There's the thanks for your call, Woody.
And
for certainly articulating what I think we know is out there, which is really incredibly strong feelings on this subject. Julie.
Although, if you actually look at the polling, you have the people on this side that it should absolutely be the woman's choice, no regulation. That's a very small minority. The people on the other side, it should absolutely be illegal under all circumstances. That's a very small minority.
Why do they control the debate then?
Because of the groups. You said that this at the beginning, that this is an issue that is really mobilized. And now groups they're spending money. They're also raising money. It's a way for groups on both sides to actually, you know, key into a very emotional issue. And so it's better for the groups themselves to keep things polarized because they can, you know, keep their grassroots motivated, keep everybody excited, than it is to come to the middle. And boy, when you know, elected lawmakers try to come to the middle, then they tend to get hammered by both sides. I remember back in the early 1990s, Nancy Landon Kassebaum, then a senator, tried to do a middle ground parental notification law, and she just got hammered by both sides.
Well, you
there's
know,
just no winning this.
A very interesting development right now is that President Bush has reacted very strongly to being pushed hard by the right, and particularly on this issue. And according to a front page article in New York Times today, Republican congressional leaders and the White House are both pushing back and saying, don't push so hard on this. How do you interpret what's going on there?
I interpret that, and there was a quote to this effect in the story, as saying, let's let the left be the ones that look like they're foaming at the mouth. If we're very quiet and well-behaved, we'll paint them as the extremists and them as doing the blocking. I mean, I think that asking them to back off is part of the strategy rather than part of the actual process.
What do you think is going to happen? Do you have any idea?
I
don't like to speculate.
Well, it's hard to imagine that whoever is nominated, there won't be a huge fight. As we said at the beginning, the stakes, in fact, even though Roe itself, or let's not call it Roe, a right to abortion is not likely at issue even with this change. There are still really only three justices on the court now who would vote to overturn Roe. So if there were to be a fourth, it would still be 5-4. Notwithstanding, there are a lot of these key issues that could, in fact, go the other way just with the replacement of Justice O'Connor. So it is, in fact, a big deal.
And even if Rehnquist resigns, that's not going to upset that.
No, because he's one of the three. So
right.
there would need to be somebody. It would have to be one of the Breyer, Ginsburg, Stevens, or Souter who would have to go to really tip the balance for a fundamental, for change in the actual right to abortion. But because of many of these restrictions in play, it's going to be a big fight.
Julie Rovner, thanks so much for being with you. When we come back from our break, we'll continue this conversation about abortion and whether or not there is some common ground. Give us a call, 800-989-TALK. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neal Conan is away. We're talking this hour about the abortion debate in America as the opposing camps gear up for the Supreme Court nomination battle. We're in search of a middle ground. A recent CNN USA Today poll found that a majority of Americans say they think abortion should be legal under certain circumstances. Is finding agreed upon limitations the solution to the abortion debate? Would moving the process to the legislatures do it, or is there no civil middle ground? What do you think? Whatever your views, is there a compromise you can live with if it means an end to this debate? If you talk with people who disagree with you on this issue, how do you keep the conversation civil? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now in Studio 3A are Anne Stone, and she is the National Chair of Republicans for Choice, and Kristen Day, Executive Director of Democrats for Life. And yes, you heard me right on both counts.
And you never had two oxymorons in the studio at once, have
yeah.
you?
And thanks to both of you for coming in today. Anne, let's start with you.
Okay.
Tell us a little bit about Republicans for Choice, how you came into existence, and how you work within the Republican Party to promote a pro-choice agenda.
Republicans for Choice was formed in early 1990 as a reaction to the Webster decision in 1989, which was the first decision to limit Roe by the Supreme Court. And myself, as well as millions of other moderate and pro-choice Republicans, for the first time found this to become a voting issue. Even under Ronald Reagan, many of us knew he had signed the most liberal abortion law in the country and talked the talk but didn't necessarily walk the walk, and certainly two of his three appointments were pro-choice, including Sandra Day O'Connor. So that we didn't worry until that Webster decision when Roe hung in the balance by one vote.
Yeah. Why is this important for your party? I know you're concerned also about Republican support for an amendment that would ban abortions. You feel that that's something that's dangerous for your party.
It certainly is. And in fact, I always look with amusement over the fact that we've controlled the Congress since 1994. And Henry Hyde told Congresswoman Nancy Johnson and I in 92, when we tried to get the platform changed, that because we said, why haven't you brought the constitutional amendment to ban abortion, which is in our platform, up for a vote? And he said, well, in case you didn't notice, we don't control the Congress. Well, after 94, we did. So in 96, we said, Henry, guess what? And they've run away from ever trying to bring the amendment, which gets introduced every year, a form of it, and it would be a constitutional amendment to ban all abortion. Some have some exceptions, some have none. And the reason the party runs from it is because the consequences would be horrible. And I do want to clarify something before we go forward. I don't think we can find middle ground on the abortion issue, because I think people who try to find middle ground on the abortion issue become roadkill. But in fact, what we can find, and it's not compromise, we can find actual overlapping areas of common ground, of things that naturally both sides should agree on if they're being honest about the way to make abortion rare and
so let's stop using the phrase middle ground and use
Correct.
The phrase common ground.
Yes, yes.
And we're going to get to that with you as well, Kristen, but let me ask you first, so
sure.
What is that common ground from your
common
perspective?
Common ground, well, first of all, it is a way of promoting civility in this debate, which doesn't have much. And first I will say that for the purposes of this discussion, for my pro-choice friends out there who will get angry when they hear this, I will always refer to you, Kristen, as pro-life, as opposed to anti-choice, which would be generally our language on the pro-choice side. You have to start out speaking respectfully and not using inflammatory phrases. So you are pro-life. I am pro-choice. I am not pro-abortion.
I agree with that 100%.
Okay. Secondly, I'm not going to try to change her mind. She's not going to change mine. But we need to look at what would be best for women and their families, and that isn't taking place now. And actually, Hillary Clinton started this discussion on the Democrat side. Our party should have started this discussion a long time ago. We have tried to promote the idea of common ground because our party is the one that has the biggest internal fight. In some states, it's just totally ripped the party apart, and it's driven millions of women from the party, and as well as moderate voters. And I hear from them all the time, so I know that they're still staying away. But in fact, the party has been reluctant to do it because they've been afraid of angering the base. And if they understood the concept of common ground, they'd know nobody's going to try to change anybody's opinion. What they're going to try to do is, in a safe atmosphere, really look at areas that would be natural agreement that actually would do good things for women and families. Mm. Wow!
Yeah.
As opposed to the way this debate has gone for 30 years, where only lawyers and lobbyists have benefited.
Kristen Day of Democrats for Life, how would you define common ground, and what do you have in common with them?
Well, I think actually we have a lot in common listening to you speak, and we put together a 95-10 initiative that we've been working on over the last probably 6 or 7 months. And the whole goal of the 95-10 initiative is to decrease the abortion rate by 95% in 10 years. And it's a package of proposals that will help women and to give them more information and better information, closing the healthcare loophole, putting together a toll-free number that will send women who are in a crisis pregnancy to places that will help them and support them. And I think this is the common ground, our 95-10 initiative. Congressman Tim Ryan is going to introduce it in the Congress. We have gotten really positive feedback from people on all sides of this issue. And the time is now for people to really come together and be serious about decreasing the abortion rate and stop talking about it and actually sit down and do something. I know.
Is the goal for both then, and I want to get to some of the specific things in your proposal and we can both talk about them, both of you can respond to them, but is the goal to reduce the number of abortions? I mean, is that what you would say the goal
Absolutely.
Is?
Absolutely. The goal is to give women better choices. No woman wants to go out and have an abortion, and a lot of women feel that that's their only choice for financial reasons, from pressure from their family and friends, and we need to do more to give them better options, show them that there are adoption options, and there are lots of other options out there, and there's lots of support out there for women who are facing these.
Let me ask you first about adoption, since you mentioned it, because that is one of the you wish to strengthen the ability to get an adoption, to educate. I know that this is a big part of your proposal.
Right. We've been working with the National Council on Adoption to come up with some good proposals that will better educate women on what entails an adoption and what they can do if they are pregnant and they don't want to have an abortion, but they don't feel that they have the financial means or the means to raise the child. And there are millions of families out there who are willing to raise these children. And we just need to do more to support and help women and families facing these kind of tough situations.
Yeah,
I can agree that adoption reform is definitely a good step. But even beyond that, I want to get to the point where women never have to face the choice because they aren't getting pregnant unless they intend to. And that's contraception. And we're talking about the real disgrace in this country is most of the contraception that's available now is based on technology pre-1973 because of the active lobbying against companies that would try to develop the technology post-1973 being when Roe was decided. And that's a real disgrace. It, you know, with the ability that we have to do so much in this world, we should be able to have totally foolproof contraception. And in fact, since 60%, that's a six followed by a zero, 60% of abortion is due to the failure of contraception, you could eliminate 60% of the abortions right away if you had more effective contraception.
Kristen, I have to ask you about something in your proposal with regard to contraception, which is that you proposed that insurance coverage would be required for contraception approved by the Food and Drug Administration.
That's terrific.
I think, though, within the pro-life movement, there's a very large entity within that movement and a very powerful entity within that movement which would have a lot of trouble with that proposal, the Catholic Church.
Right,
for starters. How do you deal with that?
The hierarchy of the church, not necessarily the rank and file.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, contraception is just a key component of reducing the abortion rate. And it was one of the things that we felt was very important to be included in this package. And we model our legislation after a compromise that was reached in Missouri that the Catholic Church did actually agree with because it did have some conscience language for Catholic-run health insurance companies and things like that. So there's protection for people who are opposed to contraception and things like that.
And the thing that drives me nuts is this is coming from the Democrats. This is something the Republicans should have done ages ago.
But you know what? It's not very well known yet, I have to say.
Okay. Well, hopefully this helps.
Yeah. We have been putting this package together for the last couple months. We're probably going to introduce it very shortly. We have the support of a large number of congressmen and women on the Hill, and you probably will be hearing more about it as we continue because this is so important. We need to stop politicizing the abortion issue and really do what we can to help women and their families.
Okay, we are talking about common ground on the abortion debate, and if you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 800-989-8255. We're going to take a call now from Betty in Boise, Idaho. Hi, Betty.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Yes, I was the Democratic candidate for Congress in Idaho's 1st Congressional District in 2002. And I tried to take a middle ground on abortion because I am one of those people who truly can see both sides of the issue. And I so agree with your caller, the Republican for pro-choice, who talked about middle ground equals roadkill. In particular, in order to have the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and the other major donors in the Democratic Party, which look to the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee for the good housekeeping seal of approval, you really had to have the support of Emily's List. And I think Emily's List is an awesome organization. However, they do have a litmus test on this issue. And I was advocating prevention, education, abstinence, contraception, and I strongly supported Roe versus Wade, but I also acknowledged that some limitations were reasonable.
And what did you find? Maybe you can describe what happened to you with Emily's List. And
well, in part, in fairness, they were looking at a candidate running in Idaho's 1st District, and that's not a bastion of progressive electoral votes. So perhaps they just thought long shot in any event. But the bottom line was that you run for office, you get questionnaires, and unless you fill them out to the satisfaction of the special interest group, you don't get their vote of approval. And especially for a Democratic woman candidate, Emily's list is the gateway. A male Democratic candidate does not have to get Emily's list's support. A woman running as a Democrat does. If you don't have Emily's list, you don't really have a snowball's chance. So that's very frustrating, because I do think that that both sides, particularly I think the far right, but I do think both sides, oftentimes on the extremes, on the fringes, really use this issue rather than, they seek to use it to get out their base rather than to resolve the issue. And I really liked what your caller spoke about in terms of common ground.
Yeah.
And looking for those ways that we can agree to address
the issue. I have to tell you, that was actually Ann Stone, who is the chair of Republicans for Choice. So.
Yeah. Well, she and I have some common ground.
Well, there you go. All right. I'd like to thanks so much for that call, Betty, and for that very, very interesting perspective. And I would like to ask Ann Stone of the Kristen Day, I'm getting you guys mixed up now, Kristen Day of Democrats for Life, to talk about that and for the problems that what you're talking about pose for Democratic candidates, because women are a very large, women are usually strong Democratic supporters, and some women may be very alienated by this idea.
Betty, I'm sorry that you had to go through that, and I know we hear from candidates all over the country who face similar situations because they are pro-life and they don't feel like the Democratic Party necessarily supports them. But I honestly believe that things are changing. We are working with the Democratic National Committee to really change the attitudes toward pro-life Democrats. And it's the Big Tent is back open for business. And Howard Dean has really sent a strong message that he's willing to have dialogue on this issue and maybe be more supportive for pro-life Democrats. And we're very encouraged that if you do decide to run again, that you can run proudly and talk about being pro-life and prevention.
All right, let's take another call from, we have Steve in Tallahassee, Florida. Hi, Steve. Steve, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I would like to say that I don't think that there is much of a middle ground in this debate. I believe that one side is going for life and death. One side believes it's a life and death issue. The other side believes it's a matter of constitutional rights. And I believe that constitutional rights will always be trumped by life or death. And I don't think the pro-life crowd is going to stop until they win this debate.
Ann Stone?
I've sat in the room with some of the icons within the pro-life movement who are willing to talk about rational common, not middle, common ground, not compromise, common ground. And in fact, they understand that really women have and their families have sort of been left out in the fray of this fight, again, of lawyers and lobbyists. So I think you'd be surprised. I think as long as they think they have a political advantage right now, it's been harder to get a lot of the pro-lifers in the room to talk about this. But when you do, they actually turn out to be pretty reasonable people.
Okay. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Steve, you wanted to add something? What is your position, Steve? Steve, are you still there? I think I've lost Steve. Okay, Steve is gone. Let's go to Peter. He's in Charlotte, North Carolina. And interesting to note that a number of these callers are men, not women. Peter? I think we've lost Peter as well. Have we lost Peter?
Lucy's here.
Pardon me?
Lucy's here.
Lucy, go ahead then.
California?
All right, Lucy. I was getting a wrong signal. Go ahead, Lucy.
Okay, I tend to be one of those people who left the Republican Party, and this was one of the things that got me in that direction to become a Democrat. And I went back to college and did a lot of study to really think it through. But one of the advantages, if we can get this thing resolved, is the polarization this has caused. There are people who vote one way or the other based largely just on this when we have so many other issues that are so important, whether it's national finance, the burden we're putting on generations to come, the war, that there'd be, I would like to see all children loved, wanted, and accepted. And one of the arguments in favor of Christine Day's is, and both, the adoption. I follow very closely Russia's Putin. I have two darling little grandchildren my daughter got from Russia, and he's closed.
Lucy, I want to. We only have a little while left, and I want to conclude with my guest. And you brought up an interesting point, so thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
Again, mentioning the adoption issue, but also the fact that the one issue. The people who vote on this one issue and how difficult that is, I think, particularly in the Republican Party, perhaps for people like yourself.
Sure. Yeah. And in fact, because people broad brush the party, and in some areas of the country, if you're not pro-choice, you can't get elected. And we've got great pro-choice Republicans who get painted with this brush of not being pro-choice. So we've had to help break through the din surrounding them so that people actually evaluate where a candidate actually stands on these issues as opposed to just knee-jerk voting. But it is a filter for a lot of people. How they stand on choice really tells them a lot about how they feel about women in today's society, and also how they stand on a whole host of other issues. So they do use it as a filter.
And Kristen, just quickly, if you can tell us what's going to become of this proposal of yours, where does it go from here?
Well, we're very excited. It's going to be introduced in the next couple months in Congress, and we're also going to have 95-10 initiatives introduced in all the states, too, because if Roe v. Wade is ever overturned, it's going to go back to the states, and that's where we're going to help women and really end the abortion
Kristen
issue.
Day of Democrats for Life, thank you. And Ann Stone of Republicans for Choice, thanks also.
Thank you.
Thank you
Talk
very much.
Talk of the Nation from NPR News.